My name is Ruth Close. I was admitted to the asylum in 1924 as patient number 6419 from Washington County. I'm not buried at the asylum, but the baby girl I had while I was institutionalized there is.
From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. Baby Girl Close, as she's labeled in the old Athens Lunatic Asylum gravebook, was born the same year as her mother, Ruth, was admitted to the asylum, 1924. She's buried under grave number 504 in Cemetery 2. She has no first name, no admission number, and no patient number in the asylum records, but her story is still so important to tell because she isn't the only baby to have been born and to have died while their mother was housed at the asylum. Retired library archivist and asylum cemetery researcher Doug McCabe joins us now. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Sherry.
What do we know about Baby Girl Close?
Almost nothing more than what you've just said. She was born and died in the asylum the same year her mother, Ruth, was admitted. And the only reason we know that it's a she is that she's on the asylum grave book part for females.
Oh, okay. Ruth was 30 years old when she was institutionalized. What do we know about why Ruth was institutionalized? Anything?
Ruth was admitted, as you already mentioned, in 1924. Unfortunately, the committal papers after 1913 are not housed at the Ohio University Archives, so I can't say why she was sent to the asylum. It is possible a set of the papers, those committal papers, are located in the lunacy files at the Washington County, Ohio Probate Court.
Could she have been pregnant before she came to the asylum? Or, I mean, do we know? Did she get pregnant while she was at the asylum?
Well, without the committal papers, it's impossible to say just when Ruth became pregnant. But either way, since she was single at the time, the baby was conceived out of wedlock. So if that was the primary reason for her committal, then it's probable, but it really doesn't explain why she was there for over 30 years.
Do we know anything about why the baby died or how long the baby was alive?
The cemetery's logbook doesn't give a cause of death for Baby Close. There may be a death certificate on file at the Athens County Health Department, however.
How many other babies are buried in the asylum cemeteries?
There is one other baby with the last name of Caldwell. This baby is not identified by first name or gender, but was born and died in 1901. This child ties in with May or Mary Caldwell, who was admitted in 1901 as patient number 3538 from Noble County, Ohio. Mary was born in 1872, married in 1891, and between then and 1901 had had five children. She was a patient at the asylum until at least 1945, but was in the Noble County home in 1940. She may have died there in 1948, although she is buried at Sharon Cemetery in Noble County. The cemetery's logbook does note another baby, the Stuyvesant baby, who died in 1916, but in place of a grave, the book notes lab, which I suppose stands for laboratory. The mother, Ida Stuyvesant, was admitted as patient number 5076 from Jackson County, Ohio, in 1913, readmitted as patient number 5382 from Jackson County, Ohio, in 1916, and readmitted as patient number 5685 from Jackson County, Ohio, in 1918.
Hmm. Well, I feel like there's so much, obviously, that we don't know about baby girl Close and these other babies who are buried at the asylum. Do we know, though, if the asylum was even equipped to take care of a pregnant woman and their babies after they were born?
I think it's fair to, we have to, you know, make some assumptions, but I can say that by 1924, the asylum had a separate building equipped as a clinic with examining rooms, hospital patient rooms, and even a morgue.
Okay. So there might have been some support there for pregnant women at that point?
Let's hope so.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Doug. Now it's time to hear more about baby girl Close's story through a first-person style account from her mother, Ruth, with the help of voice actor Beth Kraft.
I was born on November 7th, 1893, in Muskingum Township. My parents were Peter and Lizzie Daniels. I was one of 11 children. My father was a dairy farmer. I was 30 years old when I was admitted to the asylum in 1924. And after having my baby, I remained in the asylum until the 1950s. I died on October 20th, 1957, and am buried at Putnam Cemetery back home in Washington County.
Now joining us is Jackie Wolf. She is a professor emeritus of social medicine, a historian of medicine who specializes in the history of women's health and children's health, along with the history of public health and the history of biomedical ethics. She's also the host of WOUB's Lifespan podcast. Jackie, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me, Sherry.
Of course. So, Jackie, when you hear that three babies are buried at the Athens Asylum, does that surprise you?
It doesn't. It doesn't. Babies who were born in institutions in that era or housed in institutions for whatever reason had an astronomically high death rate in that era.
Okay. So Ruth was institutionalized in 1924, and her baby was born that same year. If a woman were to become pregnant out of wedlock during that time, would a possible option be to send them away to an institution like the asylum?
You know, I can't exaggerate enough the stigma that was associated with becoming pregnant and not being married, not just in the 1920s and earlier, but right through even the 1960s. Women were sent away regularly. They would literally disappear for a certain amount of time, and then they would come back and the family would tell some story, like some relative needed care in a distant place, or they had a terrible infection and needed to get care at a special hospital far away. Institutionalization would not have been uncommon either. Certainly it was more normal to send them to a state maternity hospital in that era rather than institutionalize them in a mental hospital. But it was definitely not unheard of because the stigma was so great for a pregnancy when you were unmarried that you were subject to almost any punishment. And it would have been a punishment.
Wow. So I think along those same lines, it's interesting that when Ruth died, she was buried back home in Washington County, even though she spent more than two decades at the asylum. Does the fact that the baby wasn't claimed and buried back at home tell you anything about Ruth and baby Close's story?
Well, I'll tell you, it tells me a lot about Ruth, because my guess is, and again, this is all conjecture, you know, we're talking about people who died without a voice, without a history. So as a historian, I'm trying to give her a voice and I'm trying to give her a history, but it's purely conjecture. You know, my guess is, given the extreme, and again, it can't be exaggerated enough, the extreme stigma associated with a woman becoming pregnant and not being married, I can guess that she might have become very depressed. Very possibly one of the reasons the baby died was because the baby wasn't being breastfed. This was an era when almost 13% of babies died before their first birthday, and more than half of them that died of diarrhea because they weren't breastfed. So my guess is that this baby very well might have died of neglect. If Ruth was depressed, she might not have been able to adequately care for the baby. There might not have been a provision for the baby even to stay with her. Because my guess is she was housed in a ward. There wasn't a provision for a baby being in that room. So if the baby was isolated, the baby probably was not properly taken care of. If Ruth was suffering from severe postpartum depression, she probably, you know, had little awareness of the baby or care for the baby. So the fact that the baby's body was abandoned, I think that that tells a lot about the state that Ruth was probably in.
We've talked about this in past episodes, but if Ruth was pregnant and unmarried when she was admitted, women didn't really have the right to fight being institutionalized. I mean, if her father or a male relative said the asylum was where she needed to be, it just happened, right?
You know, Sherry, there's a really interesting book written by a woman named Anne Fessler, F-E-S-S-L-E-R, called The Girls Who Went Away. And it's a hidden history of what happened to women when they became pregnant before they were married. And I cannot tell you, women had no rights. I mean, you're alluding to the fact that Ruth had no right to even fight her institutionalization. She would have had no right to fight to keep that baby if the institution or her father or some male relative wanted that baby adopted. She would have had no voice. Women had absolutely no voice except through their fathers or through their husbands. And we're talking about until even in my lifetime, that was true. Until 1976, when you had something like the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, so that you couldn't fire women at will because they were pregnant and working. You know, before that, I can't enumerate. I mean, the list is so long of the rights that women didn't have. So yes, it wouldn't. How could she have fought it? There was nothing protecting her.
We've also talked about on previous episodes about how some families probably appreciated the fact that their relative was only buried under a number because there was no family name to associate with them. In this case, they didn't even give this child a first name. Do you think that had to do anything with the stigma, or what is your theory on that?
Well, again, it's going back to trying to piece together Ruth's story. And, you know, my guess is if she didn't name the baby, she probably had no relationship with the baby. And again, she might not even have held that baby. I mean, again, pure conjecture. But it you know, as much as the people buried in that cemetery, so many of them are nameless, for an infant, probably that's magnified. Because theoretically, that infant did have a biological mother, but if the biological mother had no voice, imagine what the care of that baby was like. It probably was nil. That baby probably got no care. Babies in institutions, you know, I should say, if they were institutionalized and didn't have access to their mothers, babies died at a rate upwards of 90% in that era. But for a baby to die just within days, it's very possible that they just set the baby aside and didn't even give the baby any nutrition. You know, this was a place that had no provision for caring for an infant, and it could be that the family wanted no part of the infant. Again, pure guesswork. But that would not have been an unheard of story in that era.
Yeah, I mean, you keep saying it's pure guesswork, but it's based on what happened to others that you know of, right?
Exactly. It's based on demography. It's based on statistics. It's based on what we know from what physicians have said at places like foundling homes and the number of babies who died. So yes, it's based on the provisions for care for babies who were essentially abandoned. And it sounds like, you know, I wouldn't say that Ruth, that there was no voluntary here. It's not like she voluntarily abandoned her baby. She had no agency whatsoever. There was no one to speak for her, and certainly that meant there was no one to speak for the baby.
All right, Jackie Wolf, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us today on this subject.
Thank you. I'm really glad you're giving voice to the voiceless. And that's what we're trying to do.
Now we're going to take you outside of Athens to talk about work being done in other communities to restore dignity and respect. Joining us now is Michael Johnson. He works for the Fairfield Heritage Association in Lancaster, Ohio, which is just up the road from Athens, about an hour away. Michael, thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. So I started a social media channel called Lancaster Preservation, and it is dedicated to cleaning and restoring headstones and cemeteries in the area. And not only that, but also telling the stories of the headstones of the people that I clean.
So why do you think that that is such an important thing to do, to clean the headstones and then, of course, tell their stories?
Well, I got into this through genealogy. I started doing genealogy about 12 years ago. And anybody who's done genealogy research is going to find themselves in a cemetery at some point looking for information. And trying to visit some relatives' headstones and making those sorts of trips, I just come across a lot of headstones that are damaged or they're not legible. And I don't know, it just really struck a chord with me. It was kind of like almost like a second death. Because it's almost like a loss of a memory when you lose a headstone. And so that was my goal, was to try and preserve these for as long as possible and to tell the stories of those people that are buried.
So that's very similar, obviously, to what we're doing with this podcast and telling the stories of the people buried. Have you come across any unmarked gravestones with just numbers or things like we've experienced here at the old Athens Lunatic Asylum?
The numbering, not so much. Now, there are plenty of unmarked ones. Lots of unmarked ones, of course.
So tell me what you mean by that.
So we have something similar here in Lancaster. We have the Infirmary Cemetery, which is across from Ohio University Lancaster. And that was back in the 1820s, starting an infirmary, mainly for poor people, transients, basically people who have nowhere else to go. They started this infirmary and home. And there's a cemetery attached to it. It's roughly the size of a football field. And I think there are about 6 markers remaining. And the estimates of how many people are buried there go from 500 up to 900.
Wow. So what do those markers look like? If they aren't numbered, how do they identify in any way who's buried there?
The ones that are still there have names and typically birth and death dates. There is a generic one that just is in memory of those that were lost as kind of an homage. Yeah, to whoever's buried there. But yeah, the ones that are there actually have names on them.
Wow. Okay. So at one point, do you think all of them were marked and then the headstones have just deteriorated over the years?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. This is one of those cases where, and again, it's not unique to Athens or Lancaster. this is something you see nationwide. It's what do we do when we're in this situation where somebody has no family? And they have no means to pay. And for the infirmary, that meant just unmarked burials.
You believe that there was never a grave marker on any of these burials at the infirmary?
On the vast majority of them, no. No, absolutely not.
So you say there's like 6 of them that are up there now. Did those occur later after people rethought the approach to burying people who were at the infirmary?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's the catch-all one, I believe, is from the early 1900s. The newest one would be from the 1980s. So that's when the infirmary officially closed down, was in the 1980s. I think they only had about 16 residents at that point. They were all elderly. Those people were sent to other homes.
Someone like you who believes that it's a second death, that a memory dies without a grave being marked, what do you do about that?
That's a great question.
Because thought about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem are that the records are so sparse. Like, we can get obituary notices in the paper. We have a local genealogy library that was able to document for sure 85 names. But we know that there's way more than 85 there. And it just goes back to, if you have somebody who doesn't have any family, who doesn't have any money, who doesn't have a long record, what do you do? And how do you document something like that that was never documented in the first place?
Do you have any evidence that maybe the names weren't put on these graves because local family members didn't want to be associated with someone who was at the infirmary, or any evidence of that kind of treatment?
I don't see any evidence of that. In fact, there are a lot of articles about the pride that people took in the infirmary, which is kind of odd, seeing as how it ended up. But, you know, they took pride in this being a good institution, and it was a charitable thing. You know, and it never was one thing for its whole life. I don't know if that makes sense, but it did take in paid customers, I guess you could say, paid patients. It took in older folks, became an older folks home, and it was a charitable hospital. So it was a big mix of different things.
Hmm.
But even with that, for whatever reason, when it comes to burials, it's just poorly documented. They did do ground penetrating radar several years ago to try and locate some of the graves, because they were trying to locate the edges of it. The thinking at the time was they could fence off where everybody was buried, but that came back inconclusive, and they weren't able to locate all of the bodies. There was some drainage and different things that was getting in the way of the GPR. So they've tried to locate, but it just hasn't been successful.
Hmm. So is there an effort underway to do something to mark these graves in Lancaster, or is it just that you all at the Heritage Association and other people who study this are going to know about it, but there's not anything formal that's ever going to be done?
Well, I wouldn't say not ever be done. I think the first thing is to try and figure out, can we get a better idea of how large this cemetery actually is, and can we get an idea of the number, and then how do we go about marking this in some way? There are things that we're looking into, but right now, no, there's no official plans.
You said earlier, and I think this is important to point out, that, you know, this story and the story of the Old Athens Lunatic Asylum, they're not unique. This is in almost every community across the nation. And there's so much work to be done to be able to restore dignity and respect for these people. So here's to hoping that you're talking about it and others talking about their cemeteries and their communities will spark action.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is something that every community has to deal with at some point in time. I mean, and it's not only just the asylums and the institutions, but it's municipalities as a whole have to figure out, you know, what do we do with the dead?
Before we go, just please, if you could, tell us a little bit about the work you do to restore gravestones, because I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know there was anything you could do to stop their deterioration. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So I'm a certified cemetery conservator. This is a new field. this is something that a lot of people are just beginning to learn, and the research is just starting to come out. But the big thing when it comes to cemetery cleaning and restoration is to make sure that that what you're doing is doing no harm. That's number one. Cemeteries are full of headstones that have been damaged by people with good intentions. People that went out, they took their Dawn soap because the Dawn soap worked great. They saw it on the ducks getting the oil off, and this has to be the gentlest thing I can put on there, and it's terrible for headstones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I only use a product called D2, and D2 is what they use at Arlington National Cemetery. It's a biocide, and that's what really destroys a headstone, or the little biological growths, because all these stones have pores, and all of these little biological growths start to grow inside of the stones and press out and cause cracks and damage it. So a nice biocide like D2 kills that. No headstone's going to last forever, but my goal is to hopefully make it last for just one more generation, be able to see it.
Wow. Well, keep up the amazing work that you're doing in Lancaster to restore headstones so that those stories and those people are not lost. And we'll check back in with you about the infirmary in the future and see what work is being done there to help identify some of those people.
That sounds great.
Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Now we turn to you. Talking with Michael helps us to see that there is so much more work to be done to give a voice to those who are voiceless. We want to hear your stories about long-lost relatives in your families who you believe may be buried under numbered tombstones or an unmarked cemetery across the country. We'd love to share your story and see if the work done here in Athens might lead you to some answers and maybe even a name on their grave marker. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer, artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe, Jackie Wolf, and Michael Johnson for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast, and Beth Kraft for her work as the voice of Ruth Close. If you like the show, please rate and subscribe, or visit woub.org to learn more.